Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon by three titans of wealth management, Alex Scott, Charles Hambrough and Piers Headley. Between them, they've amassed more than a century of experience in a business that has changed hugely in just a few short years. The financial crisis, the rise of millennial billionaires, and the advent of investment algorithms have all threatened to derail this sometimes opaque and old-fashioned industry. But today, our guests give us an unprecedented insight into wealth management's inner workings, its future, and the strategies that will secure it. Along the way, Alex, Charles, and Piers tell us how they can instantly tell a good entrepreneur from a bad one, how the wealthy make their own luck, and how everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Gentlemen, what a treat to have you all here. Thanks very much for joining us. Each of you has been in the industry of wealth management or private wealth for a number of decades, probably a century of experience between you, which is cumulative, I hasten to add, not an average. But I'd just like to know what the single biggest change since you first cut your teeth in this industry has occurred over the last few decades. Maybe Alex, if we kick off with you.
I think the single biggest change, well, look, there have been loads, but I'm just going to start with one. The single biggest change would be the extraordinary development of the landscape of investment opportunities. 20, 25 years ago, life was pretty simple. What's happened is not only the opportunities to invest have exploded in terms of their complexity and opportunity, but the providers of those opportunity have exploded as well. I think there's been an exodus of talent from big to small. I think that there's an overlay of complexity there, which has changed the way people can invest.
Yeah. And is that a technological complexity? Has the introduction of data modeling and computers made that more complex?
I think it's that. I think it is the overlay of technology. I think it's also just, maybe there's a slightly more entrepreneurial objective within investment people to go off and do their own thing as well. Yeah. I mean, I think that the number of small boutiques offering very specific services has just exploded. We're surrounded by them here.
Yeah.
And I think that's made the challenge of deploying assets all the more difficult and all the more interesting.
Sure.
There are lots of other changes, but that's the one I'll start with.
And Piers, what about in your experience as far as great changes go?
Well, I spend most of my time sitting on the client side. So other than helping Alex with some of the strategy around the wealth management business he owns, it's more sitting on the client side. So I think there has been probably more cynicism from clients about what advisors can do. And I think in the past, certainly pre-2008, I think clients probably accepted at far more face value what the advisors said. And I think that 2008 and all the things that arose from that have made clients ask harder questions.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably good and healthy for everybody. But definitely also technology is having a big impact on the whole business, because clients want to have ways of consuming information which is different than just getting paper reports than they used to do in the past, and that pace of change is accelerating, probably.
Of course. And Charles, have you noticed an increased cynicism in the people you deal with, the clients you deal with?
No, I don't think there's necessarily any change in the cynicism. I think, going back to your original question to Alex, I would say two real points in answer to you. The first was particularly in a British sense, but also in a global sense, was the Big Bang in 86.
Right.
Which fundamentally changed the financial service industry, specifically in the city, but also in the more general sense. And the way things were done pre-86 mm-hmm. Was, as people said, a much more club element to it. The clients were very often much less well-informed about the markets or indeed the opportunities available to them. After 86, you got a much more American, a much more investment banking, much more product-based type service coming in. And that obviously changed the whole dynamic of the industry. And you can say it's good or bad, I suspect. Yeah. Most people would say in the main it was for the good, even though some people might argue it was the start of the road to 2008.
Yeah.
But I think overall it was a good thing. The second is obviously, which has been touched on already, but is the internet. And the internet, you could sort of say technology, whatever you want to say about it, but what is the internet doing? In essence, and as a very sort of broad brush statement, and financial services is in no way insulated from this, but the internet is actually, in simplistic terms, taking out the middleman.
Yeah.
That's what it does. And it brings the consumer who wants a product, whatever that product is, in direct contact with the producer of the product. And that, of course, is a huge challenge for all industries and specifically the financial services industry, because that, of course, is one big middleman.
Yeah. So is there a sense now that people with a great deal of money feel like they can do it themselves? They don't need to go to advisors or particular investment firms to get advice?
Well, I come back directly to you. The answer is they can do it themselves.
Right.
And
if that's the case, would that not put
if you're a very rich individual in the UK, again, in very simple terms, but what has the internet done? Is the internet has said you can pick up your telephone and you can have a direct conversation with an entrepreneur in China, for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
Now that, in the old days, I go back to pre-86, if an entrepreneur in the UK wished to do a deal with someone in China, if you could in 1986, it would be very difficult, but if theoretically you could have, you would have probably gone to Jardines in Hong Kong and said, can you please help me out? Because they would know and you wouldn't. That is now what partly 86, but specifically the internet has done, is it's actually allowed knowledge and contact to between the consumer and the producer to, they can talk now direct.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest challenge any financial services business now faces. How do you therefore make yourself valuable?
And we spoke about the events of 2008 and the financial crisis. How has regulation impacted the industry since then? And has it made it more difficult, or do you think there should be even more regulation, Charles?
It seems to me that, if we go back to 2008, we all know what happened there, and therefore the increase in regulation, which we've seen since 2008, it doesn't matter whether you agree or disagree, or it doesn't matter whether you think it works or it doesn't work. It had to come in. I mean, it may or may not be a good thing, but bearing in mind what happened, and one can go through the history of it, everyone has their own views and everyone's right, and you know, in their own way and whatever they say, but there is no question now that one's got to the point of regulation of financial services where there is certainly a feeling that the more you regulate, the less profitable the industry becomes. And the less profitable the industry becomes, that is a real problem in terms of capital, because anyone investing in this industry at the moment would look at the capital returns. You look at the principal costs, which are obviously salaries, technological costs and now regulatory costs. And that is now getting to the stage where the regulators may be happy.
Right.
But the problem with the regulators is they're looking for a riskless environment.
Right.
If you have a riskless environment, it is very, very difficult to make a profit.
Absolutely. Has that been your experience, Alex?
I think that I'd agree with all that. I think the result of all that, I'm just rephrasing it, is the cost of being in business has gone up. And the most significant element of that cost is the regulatory requirements. So looking at another way, and I entirely agree with the comment on whether the return on capital will change for investors. I think the other way is actually it's probably a barrier to entry for new businesses setting up.
Yeah.
I do worry that having had decades of entrepreneurial activity in the financial services sector in London and any other major financial centre, that that may be at risk. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because as we've acknowledged, you know, the regulator is there for a reason and the regulation had to come, but it may just be an unintended consequence of that, is that the barriers to entry have got so high that we see less entrepreneurial activity.
Yeah.
If I can,
of course, Alex, come in on that, really, to make the point further. When I talk to all sorts of people, it's quite interesting that the people who now appear in the, for want of a better word, wealth management, using the broadest definition one can of it, but the people who appear to be making very, very serious amounts of money are actually in the unregulated business.
Right.
And that's where it's, if you like, from an underground point of view, what's going on now is that there's enormous activity in the unregulated world.
What's an example of an unregulated wealth manager, for example?
For example, investor A comes across opportunity in company X to invest either debt or equity or a hybrid or whatever it is, and he rings around his friends and says, let's form a club deal and do it.
So more ad hoc arrangements.
Yes, yeah. And it's investor A is, say, talking to investor B, C, D, E, F, and saying, let's invest in company Z, because company Z needs the money. Yes, what a good idea, away we go. It's a sort of upmarket crowdfunding, for want of a better word, but it's not regulated. And of course, you don't have any of the costs.
And you think that's a very good thing, or do you think that's a dangerous trend?
No, I think it's a good thing, because as long as the people involved in it understand from their own perspective the risks and indeed rewards they're taking, it's a very, very cost-effective way of making an investment. And I'm sure some of my colleagues around this table have come across those sorts of deals. And they are very active at the moment, I think it would be fair to say.
Another change that I hear spoken about a lot is the change in attitudes between millennials and the older generation, and how they want to deal with their wealth, and if they're inheritors, the kinds of decisions they make. Piers, what's been your experience of the younger generation?
Well, I mean, again, if you look at the reports rather than just my opinion, I think, millennials certainly in the surveys are very fixed on costs. You know, they want low cost service. They want, to consume information.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's a kind of,
I think it's just
effect,
the world we live in, of, comparison shopping. And, they are used to seeing what they see to be price driving the decision making.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's right or not, but I think that's what people have identified as the number one trend. And, and I think then it's about consuming the information. So the interface they're used to is an Amazon type interface, and all those things, and the simplicity of buying things through Amazon or whatever, and it's a whole state of mind, I think, about how they feel that information should be given to them and how they can access services. So I think that's a challenge of how the financial services world communicates with those people. But if you look at some of the product providers, I was looking at the new UK Vanguard site, to be able to get from nothing to being an investor is an incredibly simple process. Now, that is buying a product as opposed to being, giving advice, which, but I think for these young people, they want to make it much more analogous to an Amazon experience than something where you feel, you're going to see the headmaster and having sort of complex processes to go through and a lot of jargon spoken at them that they don't understand. And then I think the other element, which, I know, Alex's firm is very involved with, is the issue then of, ethical, socially responsible impact, whatever you want to call it, investing that for the younger generation is important. And, I saw the stat the other day that, within 10 years, that millennial generation will control, a clear majority of all the assets out there. And, you know, it behoves the wealth management industry to respond to their agendas.
Sure. If you've got this generation who's naturally averse to speaking to wealth managers in a traditional setting, how, Alex, do you convince them to come into your office? And how do you stop them firing you once their parents are dead, to put it bluntly?
Well, that's two questions. The first I would say is, I think bringing forward the opportunity for a dialogue about what it is they want, recognizing that they want something different, and having the opportunity to talk about this and developing a vocabulary between us to help us mutually understand what people want. That sounds all very fluffy. But this is much more complicated than buying something off Amazon. It's multifaceted, multi-layered. It really, what you end up with will reflect deeply your values, your time horizons, your age, your income needs, a huge layer of influences will come upon that. Now, you may be able to write that into an algorithm, but then you have to trust the algorithm. I trust algorithms to buy something off Amazon.
Yeah.
If it's about investing my savings, then I'm going to want to know a lot more about it. So I think the way we do that as an organization is we recognize that it's a deep and serious and thoughtful conversation. We'll end up with a better outcome than if we simply write an algorithm. But then you have to be able to afford that to come through the door. This is a high-end, expensive service. But then we can create something that really does look, feel, and behave as if we expect it will, in the context of the individual's requirements. How do you turn that into something that is immediately accessible and desirable for that buyer? I think we're all trying to work it out still. It's not just about having a slicker website. It's probably that's the place you probably start, but ultimately it will require engagement and conversation, because that's where you can unpeel the subtleties of what people really want.
Yeah,
and that's just so different from buying a T-shirt.
Absolutely, and there is another threat, of course, to wealth when it's accumulated in such a single place, that it's vulnerable to a kind of cyber attack, which is a new thing we're seeing. As a private banker, as a wealth manager, how much can you mitigate, and what can you do to stop hackers, say, getting hold of your client's data and interfering with your own confidentiality? Alex?
Simply by investing in the best we can.
Right.
It's a really significant line of expenditure for us, is ensuring that our systems are as robust as they can be.
Mm-hmm.
They're not invulnerable. Nobody's system is invulnerable, as we've found out. So we talked about the degree of costs that have increased in terms of compliance. Well, the costs in terms of ensuring the resilience of IT systems has gone up as well. And we continually work at it. Only today I was getting an email about another layer of security we're putting on. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on, and it will never stop. So I think we just have to invest in it and ensure we have the best advice that we can, and ensure that we've got the appropriate resource in-house to be able to respond to that advice.
And I think, you know, you see a lot of the problems are actually, you know, I can speak for it on sitting on the client side, is that, you know, clients and very often their children are very indiscreet in social media. And so stuff gets out there that creates increased probability of cyber threats as a result of people just not thinking through what they're showing on social media, and they're not putting proper protections on it, and so people are living out their lives. And you know, you see, you know, sometimes very, very indiscreet commentary to do with what should be private family matters on social media networks. And so I think for families, you know, they do try and spend time on educating people on using that. I mean, you know, so clearly the fundamental systems can be threatened, but they can be compromised by people just being indiscreet as well.
And Charles, is reputation and confidentiality and security, is that the kind of biggest asset and the hardest thing to earn for a private banker or a wealth manager?
Reputation. Very, I mean, that's top, really.
Number one.
That's the number one. The the, you say, the protection and the security, that, you know, that goes hand in hand with it. But the straight answer to your question is that reputation is all.
Yeah.
You know, as someone once said to me, it takes you 100 years to get it and 5 seconds to lose it.
Right. Have you ever seen any examples of that?
Yes.
Right. And what's the kind of thing, what are the kind of risks that people take that make them lose their reputation? I can't imagine anyone would do anything deliberately cavalier that might endanger that.
Well, the reputation isn't necessarily, I think your guess is all criminal or right. doing so. No, I don't think that's it. It's reputation is in terms of making the wrong call once too many times. My late father once said to me, and I won't bring any names into this, but people can probably guess what it was about 20, 30 years ago when we were asked to help someone out and sort of said, well, we had to do this 100 years ago. And this is the second time in 100 years. And once is okay, but twice is too many.
That's
and that's reputation.
Yeah.
You know, and it's crucial. The word undoubted in the financial service business is hard-earned and crucial.
Yeah.
And once you've got it, you don't lose it, because if you lose it, it's over.
I suppose now this kind of wealth is much more international. It's spreading to new cities and new countries. How has the profile of the average person approaching a private wealth manager changed, Piers, in the last 10 years even?
I mean, I think clearly there's a lot of wealth being created in Asia, yeah. for example, where, you know, if you particularly focus in on China,
sure.
where there aren't traditional wealth managers in the same way, because the amount of investment assets that were available domestically in China was very, very limited and very mostly state funds of various types. Mm. And so suddenly this wealth is looking for access to more global products. And I think it provides a, you know, big opportunity for wealth managers outside China in this case, because, you know, the speed to get up to the knowledge that's required to give advice on global asset classes, you can't just suddenly acquire overnight. And they're, of course, the local managers, they've got the relationships. They don't want to lose the relationship. Yeah. So they're very reluctant to engage with, you know, the big international brands. So I think there's an opportunity for specialists to work with those sorts of managers yeah. to give them more global solutions. But you know, wealth is definitely being created in new places. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not to say that North America and Europe still isn't the largest chunk, but if one looks at the incremental wealth, there's a lot of it coming from places where wealth management is not so well developed.
Yeah. And you all must have been approached at various times for advice and counsel and investment from young entrepreneurs at different stages of their journey. How do you know a good idea when you see one, for example? Is it a sense of the person themselves, or is it just a sheer breakdown of the numbers, Charles?
I'm very old-fashioned. I've always gone with the person.
Really?
Yeah. Always, in my view, you always go with the person. If they're really good, they can sell double glazing to the Eskimos.
Right. And what's a trait of what impresses
you? It's just how they... It's called presence.
Right.
They come in, they have presence, and they can... You think that person's got it.
Right.
So, of course, the idea's got to be good, but it's people that make businesses.
Absolutely.
Ultimately.
Has that been your experience, Piers?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, it is passion. It's about, you know, things never go right in new business things. So they've got to be, you know, they've got to be modest enough, despite being passionate, to accept that maybe they're wrong, mm-hmm. you know, to listen to advice, to be flexible, to adjust their strategies to the realities of what hits them when they confront it.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with Charles. I mean, I think, you know, I'm certainly, for me as an investor, you know, it's all about the person. If I don't feel a connection with that person and feel that they are passionate, that they care, that they're going to work really, really hard and try, then I don't want to do it. And, you know, and if the thing goes wrong, but they've tried their best, they've been honest, they've been diligent,
yeah.
then, you know, I accept that as a risk. What you don't want is somebody who, you know, is just thinks that it's a free ride, and they just sit there and expect everything to happen.
Of course.
You know, so no, I'm absolutely with Charles.
I've seen a lot more businesses fail that were good ideas, but the wrong people. Right. And a lot more businesses succeed that actually the idea was well, all right, but actually the person was brilliant.
Yeah.
So just to come in on this agree fest here, I'd absolutely agree. You know, it's IQ, it's EQ, but then it's execution.
Yeah.
So, you know, the best business plan needs execution, and that will be the individual and the team of people who are there to do it. So I'm never concerned about sharing ideas and business plans with anybody, because I then get information and feedback and pushback. What really makes the difference is whether I or anybody else who's in charge of that business plan can execute, and that's when the quality of the individual will shine through or not.
To continue that point, is it more important who you know or what you know, do you think, Alex, in that case? This is a question we ask every week and get about a 50-50 split.
I think it's what you know, because you have to know how to execute. If you know how to execute, you'll meet the people you need to meet, and then so you'll follow with who you know. But I think you start with what you know and who you are.
Yeah.
Who you are, whether you are the individual who can see this through, who will deal with the incessant invasion of the business into all your waking hours and deal with it and execute and define what needs to be done, then you have the opportunity to spread your network.
Of course.
And I think, you know, I think it's key is who, you know, to understand who you are, your strengths, your weaknesses, and to be honest about it. And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, they find that very, very difficult, because it's, some people see that as a weakness. You know, I can do everything. I'm not going to admit to any weakness. This is my business. I'm not going to let go of anything. And I think the ones that are successful are, they've got passion, but they've also got some humility and self-awareness about what they're good at, what they're not good at, and, you know, do that. I think the who you know, I mean, obviously it's very, very helpful, but you never have the opportunity to do that if you don't figure out the first part of it.
Yeah. Charles, what about, where do you fall on that divide then?
Well, what Alex said is probably right. You've got to start with what you know, but if successful, who you know follows on, I think, as Alex said, and he's about right.
And I'd just like to ask another question to put you on the spot, perhaps, whether you each have a business motto or even a personal motto that you take with you through life.
A few years ago, I remember having to stand up in front of people for various reasons, and I ended what I had to say with, use the past to your advantage, but don't live in it.
Wow. That's probably a good motto for anybody in the wealth management sphere, inheriting wealth. Alex?
I don't have a motto.
Sure.
I think one of the things that has influenced me is an understanding that whatever advantages you're born with, you're not special, you're just lucky.
Right.
And I think that if one thinks about that, then that luck brings with it the opportunity and the obligation to make the most of it. And I think that's my guiding star, really, is make the most of it.
Absolutely. And Piers?
Oh, gosh. So as I spend most of my time dealing with strategy, strategy and planning and those things. And I always like that comment from Field Marshal von Moltke. So von Moltke, the elder, the Prussian-French War, 1870. And, you know, his thing was, you know, no plan survives the first engagement with the enemy.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true, but it's not a reason not to plan. What he said is, you can then adapt the plan because you've got a set of thinking and processes there that you can then adapt to the new circumstances. Yeah. And so I've always, you know, liked that one, because there are lots of people who are very rude about planning and say, what's the point, because everything changes. But if you don't have a context in which to make decisions, how good are the decisions?
I think Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face,
which is
the modern equivalent. And equally applicable. And then finally, what are you each individually most proud of in your careers? What has been the moment where you've thought, I deserve a pat on the back now?
Well, I mean, no, I think actually, you know, for me personally, I think it's the satisfaction of helping clients achieve their objectives.
Yeah.
So, you know, from mine, it's not really, because I think it's beyond, you know, you get to a certain point in your career where, you know, fortunately, if you've been successful, you don't have to, you know, increments of, you know, monetary reward and things don't actually fundamentally change your your life. So it's satisfaction from other things. So in business, you know, to me, it's helping clients achieve their things. And then obviously in family life, it's those things that go with, you know, your children's success. So you actually brought them up and, you know, they're actually decent, vaguely humorous beings who still think their parents are okay. I mean, I think that's a, you know, I think as a parent, that's a pretty great outcome.
Charles?
I'm going to pass on that one because there is something, but even today, which, I mean, something that happened, whatever it was, 25 years ago, but even today, we're not allowed to talk about it.
Okay, so it was that good.
I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, I'm just saying.
That's very misguided. That's a great answer. We could all be guessing all night.
Yeah.
Alex?
Well, I'd echo everything Piers has said, but just turning around a bit, on the basis that I've spent most of my working life pursuing an entrepreneurial objective, I suppose when I reach the time that I think I really get a pat on the back, then maybe that's when I stop doing it. So I'm not there yet.
Right.
And I think that's probably the that's what delivers the drive to most people who are entrepreneurs in creating businesses, is we're not there yet.
Yeah.
When you think you've got a pat on the back,
you're
probably
it.
Kidding yourself.
Yeah.
You know, there's something around the corner. So it's ever, you know, it's ever restless, I suppose, looking for the next thing and then the next and the next. Doesn't stop.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming in to speak to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.